Welcome everybody. This is the talk on WAFs optimization using Samba. For good reason, you might believe that my name is Amin Aziz. My name is actually Sam. I'm Sam Lidicott. You also think I'm from an organization called UFO Mechanic. That's actually the research and development identity of my employer, which is DBAM Systems. So I want you to remember that I am Sam. Just there you see a picture of me serving up some nice hot WAFs optimization. And underneath the plate is a glove on the end of a stick. The name of the glove is Amin Aziz. The guy holding the glove is me, that's Sam. And DBAM Systems, they're the guys, the real identity of the company whose development identity is UFO Mechanic. And one of my slides is in the wrong order. However, WAFs optimization is like magic, which is lots of hard work behind the scenes, mostly other people's hard work, which is what this is all based on. And particularly, we have the nice VFS layer, we have Kerberos and delegated credential support, and generally Samba has made a nice platform for what we've been doing. Here's a picture from the Samba XP party, just to go along with the theme of things. So we'll be talking about the problem of WAFs optimization, what we're trying to solve, what the solution is, how we did it, and why my mouse wheel jogs up and down like an idiot. All the other bits. Now here's the problem, which is otherwise known as SIFs performing poorly over the internet. It's nobody particular's problem, it's 25 years of unanticipated development. If we'd known how things were going to turn out 25 years ago, we'd have been ready for it, and therefore they'd have turned out differently, and we'd have been wrong, which we were. Why is SIFs poor over the internet? We can measure the poor performance of SIFs generally in the number of seconds it takes to save a file. Over a LAN, maybe you can save a file in 2 seconds, and over the internet, over a WAN, it might take 60 seconds. That's a measure of poor performance. Also, the percent of idle bandwidth wasted. You might have a 2 megabits per second link both directions, and find that when you save a file, it's mostly not used, and that's a waste of your investment in bandwidth. And also for the poor managers, some people like me might save a file twice so they can finish reading /dot while it saves for the second time. And that's another way to measure the poor performance. Then you get the WAF solutions, which cost a quite tidy sum of money as well. And the value is represented in the cost that some vendors charge for that. Here are the causes of poor performance. Some of you may recognize the cause of poor performance. That is Nigella Lawson. Now, if you thought that she was signing books in the cookbook shop, you'd nearly be right. But look again, she's not signing anything. She's standing there chatting. And this really is the cause of the problems there. Sorry. Low bandwidth, that's the pen. She's not using the pen. This is the cause of low bandwidth. There's also high latency and chattiness. There's a long queue of people there, and she's talking to them all. She waits till they finish what they're saying before she says something. And that's chattiness. And you'll notice she's only holding one pen in one of her hands. And so when she does get to use the pen, bandwidth, she's not using a lot. And so... Hey. Yes, very good. So here we have... let's examine bandwidth as a problem. We have a special antique low bandwidth pen. And compare this to LAN speed. In typical LANs that I'm familiar with, you can get 10 megabits to a gigabit per second, and file transfer speeds over the LAN up to 400 megabits per second. That's right. Compared to WAN, the fastest you might get, unless you're paying through the nose, is going to be 10 megabits a second. And worst case, it could be 30 times slower. The worst case is for cheap consumer DSL, which lots of offices happen to use. So if we give Nigella there a couple of robot pens, will she be able to sign any faster? Will the queue move faster? Well, it may move a little faster. The difficulty we saw, though, was that she spends most of her time not signing. She's not using the pen, and her company could have 10 times the bandwidth and find it made very little difference to the time it takes to save a file. So we'll look at the other cause here, latency. On a LAN, let's use 2 milliseconds as a latency figure. You can get lower or higher, depending on the performance. That means you can do 500 SMB requests a second, in the best case. Compare that to the WAN. Well, if you go up to 100 milliseconds latency, and we saw this morning from Microsoft that non-satellite link, real-life, idle latencies can be as high as 1.2 seconds. which is pretty dire, and I didn't think things were that bad. But with these figures, that's 10 or 20 requests, you can get a second. And so if you see that maybe a file operation took 500 operations, well, you can do it in a second on a LAN, and it takes you a minute or so on the WAN. And there's no way around that. So again, due to latency, not bandwidth, the WAN can be at least 25 times slower than the LAN. And when you take message size into account, the bandwidth constraints, it's going to be slower than that. So they're the reasons why it's so slow. And the chattiness, the fact that, can you believe it, SIFS, you tell it to open a file, well, sorry, as an application user, you want to open a file, and your application waits until it finds out if the open was successful, perhaps, before reading it. And certainly, it waits till it's had some data before asking for more. And you can't blame the applications for this. In the bad old days, it was quite slow to read off the media, and then very not so slow to copy from the buffer to the application, and media sped up. But nobody expected that the bus from the media to the application would be slower than the actual access time for the media. But that's how it is. So we can't blame applications for reading synchronously instead of streaming. There's cases as well where there's repeated requests for the same metadata. I've had two explanations for this. One is poor object-oriented APIs that provide one piece of information at a time, and another is that it might actually be things breaking their own op-locks and then not being able to cache information in the client. And perhaps that's the case, but we see that merely by having high bandwidth is not going to solve the problem. So the chattiness of SIFS means that the latency, the per-request delay, adds up when you have a lot of requests, can't avoid it, and then you don't utilize all the available bandwidth. That's the problems. If we look at some models of delay, we find that the size of the request divided by the bandwidth is how long it takes to transmit the request, and then of course you have the actual latency, which is half of the round trip time usually. The same for the response time. Latency upstream plus latency downstream makes RTT, the round trip time. And so the total time for a request when you're in chatty mode is the 2 times plus whatever latency goes on in the server as well. And if it's a loaded server, that wouldn't be insignificant, but I can't do anything about that. So let's have a look at some examples here. In the table across the top where it says count 1,000, this is for 1,000 requests, and the request size was 64 bytes, which I think is quite small actually, probably too small, but the response size there is 4,100 bytes, which is perhaps good for a 4K read from a file server. On the table across the top here, here's different link bandwidths, and on the side is different latencies. So on I think that's a gigabit network with a 1 millisecond latency, you could do such a read of a 4 meg file in 1 second. But if you paid a lot of money and had that as your internet, your WAN link, and it was 50 milliseconds latency, it would take you 50 seconds to do it. But the dreadful case around here is you've got a poor consumer DSL, which let's say both ends, and so that's your highest upstream you're ever going to get. With 50 milliseconds latency, it's going to take you 2 minutes to load the same file that was 1 minute over the LAN. So if we're looking how can we increase the performance, well, we could halve the load time by magically getting the internet latency down to a millisecond, or we could approximately halve it by increasing our bandwidth to 4 times the size. Well, that's doable, and maybe it's worth the money. But let's take the case where you had one megabit a second as your link speed. To halve that, you're approximately looking to times by 10 your bandwidth, or strangely, only reduce your latency to 5 milliseconds. Well, that's getting more and more doable. But what we can tell from this is that there's decreasing returns from increasing the bandwidth, but increasing costs. And with these figures, this is really, these two bandwidth figures are the optimal bandwidth figures beyond which you're wasting your money. But if there's some way to get latency down, then we're a long way to solving the problem. Here's graphs again to show the same thing. And the increase in the bandwidth makes very little difference to the time it takes to load the file, but decreasing the latency again makes a big difference. So the solution obviously was to remove the harm caused by chattiness. And so we can reduce latency by reading ahead, and in the best case it gets towards just streaming like WGET, that's the fastest you can get to. We can also reduce the demands on bandwidth, or effectively increase the bandwidth by some form of compression. And in doing this, of course, we also reduce contention for the link because there's less traffic, and so that reduces another form of latency, which is the time it takes to get access to the media. So here we go. Here we have a poor remote worker. He's the guy who's been playing Doom while waiting for files to load and save. He's got his VPN kit here, goes over the internet to his head office, and if we could just put a magic protocol extender that fixes these problems and does the right tricks, everything would be fine. So, let's see what that's going to consist of. Read ahead is the first thing. In Jeeves and Wooster, Jeeves usually saves Bertie Wooster from either death or marriage by anticipating situations and being prepared for them before he's too late. So the idea of read ahead is to abolish the round trip latency. And if we look at the red graph there, the band that represents the use of bandwidth, and it's nicely full for most of the time, which is what we like. But the poor blue graph there, the gaps we see is the time where the link is idle, waiting for the response to go out and the next request to come back. And that's a contrived graph. It represents the situation. By reading ahead, we assume that the client is going to want further data based on some heuristics, and we ask for it, and hopefully the response is already on the wire before the client actually does ask for it. And the read ahead size, as we can guess from the Microsoft talk this morning, is we want to fill the link, but no more, and so the amount we read ahead for is the product bandwidth delay, or the bandwidth times the round trip time. It's not the bandwidth of the link, though, unless you're the sole user of the link. So you really need to know how much spare bandwidth that you could use, and that's how much to read ahead by. But if we do that, the file read can use the full bandwidth of the link, good value for money, for the person who paid for the link. But other operations like file browsing are still subject to latency and the chattiness. But in early tests, just by doing read ahead, we reduced the time to load a file by 25%, which is pretty good. There's two kinds of latencies. If we know about this magic protocol extender that's doing the read-aheads, we know there's the latency of it to the server. We also know the latency from the client to it. But from the client's point of view, there's only one kind of latency. I made my request, and how long did I wait for the answer to come back? And so there is an equivalent LAN latency, which you can calculate there. And it doesn't actually turn out to be significant, but you can go over that on the slides afterwards. So, if we reduce the latency, these are the differences we can make to file load time. If we can somehow reduce latency from 50 milliseconds to 5 milliseconds by reading ahead, which you can do, and that's what happens, you reduce the load time to 5 seconds instead of 50 seconds, or in the worst case, nearly 2 minutes to 70 seconds. And that is what happens. So read ahead gives those kinds of gains, and suddenly we see at high bandwidths now, where you've paid a lot of money, you are almost getting LAN performance and using all of your bandwidth to read the file. Compression is the next one, then. It increases the effective bandwidth where it can be done. Zlib, for many kinds of files, will give 50% compression. You've effectively doubled the bandwidth. If you know something about the kind of files being transferred, you can use custom dictionaries to get better forms of compression. And in this table, this example here, by doing read ahead, latency has been reduced to, say, 5 milliseconds, and we've also doubled the bandwidth. So just with Zlib compression, to double the bandwidth, 50% compression, and read ahead, we can take 38 seconds to load a file instead of nearly 2 minutes. And that's on your cheap DSL link. So if we want to get LAN speeds over WAN, this is where it gets very exciting. If you've managed to cache the file, and if you can validate the cache and know that the cache is okay, then you can serve up the entire file from the cache, which is local. We'll see the diagram again, and you will get LAN speeds and LAN latency, and really the highest performance. However, to know that the file is valid, the cached file is valid, isn't quite so simple. And you don't want to, let's say, exhaustively check the whole local file is valid in every case, because, well, it involves the local device reading the whole file and conferring with the remote server who reads the whole file. And I'm sure the Windows server or the administrator of it won't appreciate every file being read in its entirety just because a remote user happens to have opened it. It could put an undue load on the server. So it's not simple to validate it. However, this could solve the bandwidth issues entirely. Even if the cache isn't valid, it can still help compression by perhaps serving as the dictionary for compression, because there could be similar file at both ends, and rsync works in that fashion. We could, and by MD5 I mean any good reasonable checksum, subject to the birthday paradox, but we could, you know, quickly tell if early chunks of the file is valid, or use it as a dictionary for dictionary management. And so here are the different scenarios where we can have our savings. In the case where the file was uncompressible and not cached, we merely benefit from read ahead. We can save there perhaps 45 seconds, nearly half time to load a file. Where Zlib could compress the file, instead of 2 minutes, it's down to 38 seconds. Where we had cache, but the cache wasn't valid, we still have to go over the LAN, but high compression rates, so maybe 8 seconds. But where we're reading from cache and it is valid, we get LAN speeds. But according to the model, in any case, you can expect at least to get approximately 25% savings at 50 milliseconds latency, and much, much more savings if the latency is higher. But with this model, if we do it right, we could get down to LAN performance. There's the danger with cache. We do not want to have problems with cache coherency. It pretty much sucks, and people complain, and I don't want to have to deal with it or write the magic code that guesses. So we'll have none of it. We're not going to be troubled by that. The administrators do not want to solve the problem. There's distributed file systems that can have these problems. However, oblocks really do come to the rescue. Whatever people say about Microsoft, and who doesn't, oblocks are really good. If you have the oblock, you're the only reader of the file, you can do what you like with it. If you quickly validate the file, you can then read from it at LAN speed. You know that it's valid. You know that it stays valid. If you lose the oblock, then you have to go back to the server for a read, but you can use the cache as your dictionary for compression, for reference. So you still get the advantages of compression and of very, very good compression at rates of 100 to 1, but there's no risk of serving up invalid cache. We only go to the server when we have to go to the server, but we don't always have to. So while you have the opblock, if you do have the opblock, you can pass hashes of the file or whatever to the remote proxy and get it validated, and that can be very quick and cheap to do, and then serve from the file. We can also cache metadata redirectories, because we can register for forwarded change notifications. So there's no way the client could find out our cache was invalid, because we'll know before he does that it's changed, and that we can't serve from the cache. So any other request where we cannot be certain that the cache is suitable, we will go back to the server and give the right answer. So there's no risk here of cache incoherency and serving bad data. We also want to maintain user identity, credentials, ownership rights. We want to honor ACLs and other kinds of permissions and quotas and so forth. We want to maintain locking and also, as we say, cache coherency. We can manage all of these by, in cases where we don't have the oplock, going back to the server. If we have the oplock, except perhaps for byte range locks, which I need to check, we're safe. We can serve locally without having to check too much. So using Samba 4 for this, Samba 4 with its new VFS layers and the VFS SIFs, which this was based on, maintains, as it promised, all the full SIF semantics. So we don't have to worry about conversions being made to Unix IDs and then having to convert them back to Windows IDs on the server. We took the SIF proxy and changed it. It can be integrated into the Active Directory Networks Trust System with delegated credentials, which are essential for read-ahead. If the client asks for 4K from a file and we're going to read 64K, we need to fake requests. We can do it with delegated credentials. And as far as administrators go, there's no great tricks involved. They can untick or tick the box in the management tools for whether or not the proxy, which is how it's implemented, should be trusted. And there's loads of people working on Samba. Hey, as we said, the framework's already there. It just takes such a tiny bit of work to the VFS proxy. Caching engine should be kept separate, and it could be pluggable or loadable. We validate from the server we need to. Any read response we get, we always store in the cache so that we can use it as a reference for the compression or keep it valid. But the difficulty, and this is still a question, if somebody asks to write, when should it hit the cache? And what if they try and read while the synchronous write is still pending? Are they expecting to read what they wrote? I don't even know what they expect. Or if only fools would do such a thing. And we've seen how we can cache metadata. So, if we have a device at each end, and we have it so that the client addresses the device, tries to read files from this device, not from the real server. So there's no spoofing going on, it's properly integrated. But this looks, there's Samba here with the proxy module, it looks like a Samba device, and it provides all the shares, and it forwards them to this protocol server, extender, and that forwards, again, proxies the request to the real file server. And so between here and here, that's the opportunity for lots of magic to go on. And of course, the two proxies then need to have some channel to communicate so they can do the extra operations. And that was easy. And we knew that that was the plan and it would work, and it was really going to work this time. And there's no chance of losing anybody's data. And we managed to get a good proof of concept going within a few days. And the SAMBA 4 code is very well organized, and I didn't have to understand most of the SAMBA 4 code at first. I just had to fiddle with the VFS SIFS backend. And I did. I got zlib put in there quite easily with reader heads, and by that time it got to be quite a filthy hack. Yes, and I was very proud when I found my first bug as I was testing interoperability with Windows and Unix clients, how when the SAMBA server got the oplog break message, didn't break the oplog, and we had to wait for it to time out. And that's because in the proxy backend it wasn't registering the file handles. So when it got the oplog break message, it thought, what file? I don't have any files. But that got patched within 3 months, and I was quite pleased with that, because then I knew that people were listening to me. Of course, people don't just have one server, and they have multiple servers, and they don't want to have multiple proxies to talk with them. So I think the Michael Adam will have something to say about this. I need to talk to him about it. But I grievously extended the share names in the ini file, so you could put proxy aliases in there, and we could tell which identity the server was called under, and then forward to a different server. So we could record under the local account's identity and forward to one server, and a gamer's identity and forward it to another game server. What we notice here is that the proxy has to have a separate name for everything that it proxies. And so you could end up with a lot of DNS entries, because at each site you need to have an alias for each machine that you're proxying for at the head office. And then you also need to add SPNs as well, so that when the client connects to his local proxy, he can provide delegated credentials to it. But we've managed to set a lot of that can be managed automatically when the SAMBA machine is provisioned into the domain. We can add the SPNs through the LDAP server, and of course a wildcard share there. So just for interest, if someone connected to this proxy as local accounts to the secret share, only to the secret share, it will forward it here. But here, any share they connect to under the name local games will get forwarded to the same share just here. And that's working cool, except I think with the new registry config backend, I don't think it will like names with slashes in, so we need to do something. So how are these two protocol extenders, these SAMBA instances, going to communicate to each other? Well, first I stole an unused opcode, which is bad form. I also tried using spare fields in existing opcodes, which is even worse. Yeah, I didn't. So then we tried using NT-trans, but I couldn't get Steve French to bless any particular spare number there. And finally, it was suggested that I could use NT-ioctl, because you can just pick your own there, and nobody has to bless them. And so I thought really hard at a meaningful function, and we chose OXACE, because it spells ace. And I thought that was a powerful name. I'm now slightly sorry, because it's more likely to get chosen by other people, and I should have just picked a random one. So, yes, I used a DCE RPC NDRster with IDL for the two proxies to communicate, because I was not going to write lots of hand code to marshal and unmarshal things. It would be very boring. And it was much more fun to have NDR package up the arguments and then have that sent over NT-ioctl, which gets sent over NT-trans, which gets sent over SMB. And altogether, there's lots and lots of copying going along, which makes me feel quite uncomfortable. Yeah, we should. But it works, and it's pretty cool, and so I'm quite proud. So rather than spend time hand-marshalling things, I actually came up with a sort of RPC Lite, which I think was pretty good fun, and perhaps it's not totally pure, but it runs in the same authenticated context as the SMB session. It doesn't use the extra authentication that I'd get if I used RPC natively. So it works pretty good, and I'm quite pleased with it. So, how do reads actually work when we get a read request come in? First, we want to check, can this read be satisfied by any reader heads whose responses we're already waiting for? And if so, we need to attach it to those, so as soon as they come in off the wire, the response can go back. Also, then, we can read from the cache, and if the cache is valid, of course, we can just return it straight away. otherwise, we can use it as a compression basis and issue optimized reads to the real SAMBA server. And we keep doing this until the entire read range has been accounted for and then we probably have multiple requests, and this client request then becomes attached to the callbacks of each of these requests until it will then process them, and when the final callback comes in, it can then send off the final request, reassembling the buffer. And you can have some excitement in there. Sometimes a read that's already being serviced might then get attached to you by another client read that comes in, and the first read gets the callback and frees the buffer, and the second read who's attached to it then tries to use this freed buffer, and it's not very good at all. So I managed to work out I needed to use TALOC references, but I don't really like that because my mind is too small and I can't think of these things. So I was thinking of having two-stage callbacks, one to receive the request, and then you queue another callback, or event handler, to send it afterwards. Everybody gets to see the data, and then they all get to send the data. I may play with that when I'm on a Friday afternoon. Yes, I had a very unfortunate case with Windows Vista. It was all my fault. It was reading ahead nicely, but for some reason, when Windows Vista opens a file, to read linearly, it opened a bit from the beginning and then skipped to the end and read a chunk and then went back to the beginning. But my buggy read ahead code thought, whoa, read ahead the whole file, and there's a few hundred pending requests to the Windows server, and it dropped the connection on me, and that was good fun. Another problem that occurred was when the client PC connects to the first proxy, it might negotiate, say, a 16K read size. But when the proxy connects to the Windows server afterwards, it may have only a 4K read size. So what do you do with a 16K read? And the want's at least 10K. So we have to fragment reads or writes. It's the same thing, and collect the results back. What if you write, you have to fragment a write into, let's say, four smaller writes, and then the third write fails, but one, two, and four succeed. How do I aggregate the error codes to return back? I can't think of a very satisfactory way of doing that. But it means we can't proxy requests simply at all. So collating the results can be fun, and I had a few failures on that. Yes, the synchronous callback mechanism. When a request comes in through the VFS layer, it can chain map functions so that when you send the response, it can get mapped back into the original request reply format. But I found that the same problem occurs when we send functions. If a proxy that's proxying the request is talking to another proxy, it wants to use the new ACE magic API calls with compression functions. But if it's talking to a regular Windows server, it must use a regular read. But when it sent the request, all it has is a client request struct which it can receive on, and it won't know how to map that back. And often, now I'm using NTI Octal, there's like three stages of mapping back. I need to map back my NTI Octal back to an NT trans, and then back through the NDR code until I finally get to my original structure. So we now have multi-stage callback handlers which we can in the proxy backend only, but I think that it's a very useful mechanism. And so, of course, the client read function that Samba provides can take the SMB read structure and work out which kind of read call to do. But, of course, I've now invented my own kind of read calls, which are proxy-to-proxy read calls. So I can't use the regular Samba read structure. Now, my read function, I have to use my own, which decides whether it can wrap it up as a regular Samba one or not. And then, having made the request, it then queues the reverse map handlers and then returns the client request, where I then have to add my handler, and it's very good fun. And so this is a case which we've just spoken of, where two read functions who could use different elements of the union SMB read now can't do that, and maybe we'll need to extend SMB read, but I think that that's not a good thing to do. Another change I did was changing the asynchronous callback handlers. In the VFS proxy, in the CIFS proxy handler, one of the first things it would do is decide if the call being made was an asynchronous or synchronous call. And if it was synchronous, it would then map it to a synchronous Samba call and then return. Otherwise, it would issue an asynchronous call and queue the callback handler. But I thought it was a lot easier because I was making these functions quite complex with the proxy handling code. It was much easier to make all calls asynchronous and then at the end, before I return, decide if it was meant to be synchronous and then just wait on the response in an event loop, which was a nice way to handle it. It also meant that I didn't have to provide two handlers to reverse map the functions, because I always called the callback handler when the response came back, whether it was synchronous or asynchronous, and that made my code smaller and simpler. Now, this is where I go to my slide that was in the wrong order. This is the proof of concept cache that we're using. And it's just a simple, boring linear extent. Sadly, it's based and named after the thing that it's caching, which is a file. But a certain length of the cache will be validated because we have the op lock and we've read ahead and validated that much. Other parts may be invalid but cached because we had them from before. And then there's a final extent that doesn't exist on disk, but it's pending reads, so we know where to read ahead from. Cache sadly can't have holes. It's a proof of concept cache, and the key is the user plus the server plus the share plus the path. And then we can see that if two users are reading the same file, they have a different cache file, and that's because Samba can support different underlying paths based on the username. So we can't presume that two users really are reading the same file. And when the cache pool gets full, we delete a random file and hope it wasn't open. And of course, it's harmless, but if it was open, it wouldn't free up any cache space. There's much better ways of doing it. Ideally, we don't want to have a file in the cache of the user's file. We'd rather it was an index to a big data pool whose keys were some kind of checksum based on the file, in a similar way to how rsync works. And I don't really like using a hash of the content as the key because, hey, if everybody in the world uses this software, some of them are going to get unlucky, according to the birthday paradox. So really, the cache managers ought to negotiate an actual key ID between them. But it does mean that if many users were using the same data, there really would only be one copy stored in the cache, and the most popular fragments would work. So working with Samba, I found a few bugs. There's meant to be no bugs. That's why we're using Samba 4 for this. All the hard work's been done for us. But there were some problems with multi-packet responses and begin 64K requests, which solved and submitted patches for, had to learn how good a lot of the code worked, which I didn't think I'd have to do, but there's some bonus prizes. Alas, I thought the dlist encapsulation with macros was really good, because effectively you're passing a reference, but I didn't like how people looped over the lists to find something, so I wrote this cool dlist find macro that nobody liked and wouldn't use, but I think it's brilliant. But then I managed to write a debug context which exists for Samba 3 so that you can, as Volker was talking about, have conversion functions to convert strange structures to strings to debug, but you need to talloc them. But I managed to do a macro version of it, which I feel very proud of. It wastes an awful lot of memory, but it works without having to have the debug code in Samba 4 thread safe, which it isn't. So before, the debug context was a static variable, which is bad. But that's very awkward when you're in multi-threaded code. And some of the changes there so that we could... SMB requests apparently can't be bigger than 64K, although some of them can be. And when you're trying to... the SMB receive stuff that fixes that up, it assumed that every request it had the first field to be an and X flag, which it isn't always. So adding extra flags there to the opcode table so it knew when it could check that and whether or not it was even worth checking it. And a few other tricks with SMB, with the talloc stuff, which helped me. And some users were testing it in principle and found that it worked. They liked it. I'm not lying. And they didn't feel let down or hurt at all by the poor performance. And they didn't want to give up or play around. And hey, how about some cheap brick rolling there? And so that's the end of this presentation. Open to questions, chaps.
I just wanted to say I'm very, very impressed.
Thank you, sir.
It's just seeing bits and pieces on the list. It's really nice to see how you've put it all together, and this is something that we built bits of Samba for, hoping we might possibly, because we've known this space has been around.
I waited 6 months for somebody to do it for me, and none of you guys would. So.
No, not something we're ever going to do ourselves, but that. It certainly was, very gratifying, particularly seeing things like being able to actually use some of these little features like the delegated credentials that I threw in,
nice,
sort of because I could, but, never expecting it to be picked up. So it's just nice to see that all being used for some useful purpose rather than just sitting around in a code base. So, yeah, congratulations. You've done very, very well.
Thanks. Thanks to you guys for the infrastructure being there that I need. So, come on, guys, ask me some hard questions. Ask me if it really works.
You said you're not lying.
Good man, I'm not. One point, just to be frank, which hasn't been thoroughly tested at all, is the validation on open, which supposedly gives LAN performance. I can't think why it wouldn't, but I just need to go home this weekend and write that bit of code. But the rest of it's written and does function as described.
Did you run into any cases where this actually hurt your performance?
Well, there was the case where I read ahead too much and my connection was dropped, but the Microsoft... So my question to find out today was, how many requests can I read ahead by? Microsoft said it's 128 this morning, and if you read ahead beyond that, you will lose performance. And so I realise now, particularly as well, I can't just issue a whole flotilla of read aheads. I should probably issue a few. Of course, there's two proxies. I should probably issue a few and then wait for them to come back. This is the server-side proxy. Issue a few more, wait for them to come back, and then send it across. It will increase the effective latency of the whole operation, but then you just read ahead by a bit more. So that is something for me to look at. And as the Microsoft guys said this morning, they're looking at how they're going to ration out the resources to different clients. And I need to make sure that I don't cause trouble there. And again, we're reading ahead by enough so that we fill the pipe, but not overfill it, because that can spoil interactive responses. But to do that effectively, we need to know who else is using the internet connection, and not just for SIFs. Luckily, we make bandwidth management and control devices, so we actually can get that information. But still, as it changes dynamically, we don't want to have all kinds of oscillations going on, so that's going to be fun. Yes, the question is, what kind of operations, optimizations, have we got for writes? The first one, of course, is compression. So just regular zlib compression, but also when the dictionary management is in place, so that the dictionary manager at both ends know what's in the dictionary, that can be used as a basis for compression. And so that if what's being written is similar to what this side knows is in the cache, it can send a very small message. Then there's also what's called write behind, which is when the client says, I've written it, honest gov. And it hasn't. And it makes me feel uncomfortable, because I want the user to know if something is going wrong, especially for new stuff like this. But that's the choices there. There's right behind, and to pretend you've written when you haven't, so that you can keep the return pipe full. But at the moment, we're just doing compression. Yes, the question is, how many connections can there be to the server from the proxy? It's just a Samba question. How many connections can Samba take? And
in the back-end, how many connections? Do you have one?
Oh, I see what you mean. When the client-side proxy proxies the connection to the remote proxy, it makes... Interesting question, actually. The worst case, there'll be one connection between the proxies for each remote client. But in some cases, I've been led to understood that they may share the same TCP connection, depending on the identity of the logged in users and the fact that they're talking to the same remote machine. So in the worst case, it won't be more than it would have been without the proxies, but it may be better. So it seems that in every case, you should not get worse behavior in any respect than what you would have. In fact, with this in place, the worst performance you should get should be a 25% reduction in load time if you have 50 millisecond latencies, and a bigger reduction if you have higher latencies.
The delegation that you are talking about is Kerberos delegation?
Yes.
So how is it done? Because you're using different credentials between the remote proxy and the file server?
That's a good question. The question was, how does the delegation work? Do we have different credentials used between the different proxies and the file server? It's all done using the user's credentials. Really how it works, I've no idea. This guy here does. But all I know is that if the machine, with its machine account in the Active Directory managed network, if it's selected to be trusted for delegation, then when the client machine asks for some Kerberos ticket to talk to this, the ticket is marked for can be delegated. And then those credentials are used all the way through the chain. So every operation is done with the user's own credentials.
So you're using the same security block all over the
No, what he's using is that, so you connect to your first server, which is trusted for delegation, so it gets a ticket, and because it's so trusted, it can then talk to the KDC, it gets a ticket as the user for the next hop, which is similarly trusted, so it gets the ticket from the KDC again for another hop and gets the target server. But the pack and things are all preserved right through it because it's all it's doing is changing the target server of the ticket as the KDC sees it each time.
So the summer server has to have some special attribute to be able to...
Correct. Yeah, yes. Yeah. It's a tick box of trusted for delegation in the active... Yeah, yeah, you tick the box on the property for that computer account.
Right.
So it's fairly sane to set up. You can script that, setting that up. It's a bit in a bit field eventually. And technically, it's calling into GSS API libraries that already knew about this concept of forwarding it on. So it's actually fairly sane to code. You're lucky it was so easy to do. Otherwise, it would have never quite happened.
Yeah, I'm lucky it was so easy to do. Mostly other people's hard work. So I have to say thank you to the Samba guys for doing it all in the first place.
Correct.
NTLM doesn't proxy very well at all. There are some tricks, but they get pretty nasty pretty fast. And
sysadmins don't like nasty tricks. So.
Yeah.
Is this like V2K3 or V2K delegation?
I don't know that there's... It's Kerberos delegation. I'm not sure what the different rules are with when... I haven't heard of there being a difference in Kerberos delegation in Windows 2000 and Windows 2003. I think there's some extra features, because NTLM sucks so badly, I understand there are some features where, for a particularly well-trusted server, it actually gets to make up a whole Kerberos ticket on itself for because if you came in with NTLM and you want to use Kerberos for the rest of it, I think that might be what the later Windows 2003 delegation is, but that's not something this is doing. Do the user and the server need to be in the same domain? They just need to be Kerberos trusted. Yeah, the realms would need to know each other so that the Kerberos stuff can flow back and forward. But that wouldn't need to be strictly the same domain, but they would have to be in the same forest or have the right trusts. Otherwise, the Kerberos magic won't work.
That's the case, yes.
So you can't actually manage multiple domains?
You can, as Andy just said, as long as the two domains trust each other, so they're in the same forest, and that the...
Well, if they're not, you would just effectively, you could still do it in software. I don't know what Samba's product does, but there's nothing, you just would need Samba to be joined to both of them.
No, I don't know how Samba can be joined to more than one domain, but
Multiple prefixes and multiple IP addresses and
multiple
things.
Multiple instances and IP addresses, which
yeah.
is, So you could do lots of domains on one piece of hardware, but if you needed multiple domains, it suggests you have so many users as well that perhaps it would be an enormous piece of hardware, and you may just want to have a different piece of hardware for each domain.
Yeah, exactly. You don't need one. Goes mad it's if you don't.
There's no way to run an AD.
Indeed. Any more questions, chaps? Thanks very much.